Welcome to the What Anyone Can Do podcast with Leo Battari and me, Randy Cantrell. This show picks up where our previous show, You're the Peer, left off, highlighting the simple truth that who you surround yourself with matters, and that if we enlist the support of others, give back to those who give to us, and pay it forward for the next generation, we can do anything. Author and keynote speaker Leo Battari and I talk with a diverse group of thought leaders who will share stories and insights that will help you succeed in business and in life. How? By doing the things anyone can do, but most of us never will. Welcome back to another episode of What Anyone Can Do, the podcast. This is the 2020 season, episode two. Yeah, episode two. We're recording this on Wednesday, January the 15th, 2020. My name is Randy Cantrell. He is Leo Battari. The website is leobattari.com. That's leobottari.com or peernovation.co. That's right. .co.
That's right.
So, okay. Went to LSU, as Randy Newman sang, went in dumb, came out dumb too. It was 100 years ago when I was at LSU. Lived in married housing right across from Tiger Stadium. The team, well, let's just say the team was not very good back in my day. But here they are, national champions in college football. Pretty terrific.
Well, and pretty dominant. When you think about it, you know, I mean, it was interesting to watch the early part of the game where, given how quickly Clemson came out and how successful they were, you know, early on. And yet anytime you see a team, that I've watched, when you see a team that's really dominant, but then you look at the score and it's still close and the team they're beating is still hanging around, it's never a good sign. That was definitely one of those things that happened. With Clemson the other night, that, you know, once LSU kind of settled down and figured a few things out, it was just pretty incredible what happened there. Not exactly, you know, like what happened with Houston and Kansas City, you know, in terms of they actually did get out to a big start. 24-0 lead, only to be outscored 51-7 over three quarters, which is just, I read something where they were apologizing to the Chiefs fans because they ran out of fireworks because they do fireworks after every score, and, you know, they just, what are you going to do? So,
fireworks. That's a good problem to have. Well, and living proof that it's, great starts are great, and you love to have them, but boy, is it not all about how you finish, you know?
Oh, no question. You know, what's really interesting is when we think about, you know, you come off of a, you know, national championship game like this, and you see both teams performing at an unbelievably high level. I mean, they're, you know, let's face it. I mean, they're already projecting Clemson to, you know, win the whole thing next year, you know, because of everybody they got coming back and all of that. But it's it really, I think, is a great reminder that it really all starts with the right people. Yes, it's great coaching staff and all of that, but at the same time, these people and how they drive one another and what that looks like on the very best teams and how they really rally around a common purpose, which isn't always about winning a national championship. In fact, it usually is not. You know, I think those teams are really about, how do I get better? How do I play the very best football I possibly can? And how do I help everybody on my team do the same? And if we do that, then we put ourselves in a position to compete for anything. And national championships become the reward for that kind of commitment and that kind of effort. And, you know, it was just extraordinary to see, you know, what LSU did. As a buddy of mine, Ed and his wife, C. Landry, Ed and C. are huge LSU fans. And they had a big party at their house for the final, which unfortunately I was traveling and I wasn't able to go, and that was unfortunate. But you know, he's a LSU guy, and it just I couldn't be happier for him. They had an amazing, as they always do, amazing party at their house with everyone's in the full dress, and like yeah. it's not a gathering where you wonder, you know, who they're rooting for. You know, right. Everybody's in purple and gold, and the whole yeah. shooting match. They had it all going in serious garb. So, but really good stuff. But you know, you'd mentioned, by the way, because I think as we were talking just before we get started, we start thinking about teams. We're thinking about the right people on the right team. You know, a little bit like Jim Collins, getting the right people, you know, at the right company, but then in the right seat of the bus, even inside that company. But you know, we should really talk about quarterback of Clemson in that regard. And what an incredible example that is. And you, I think told that story pretty eloquently when we were.
Well, both of those quarterbacks. But if you just start from the LSU front, you know, there's been some things written, and even just today here in Dallas, Joe Klatt, who works for, I guess he works for CBS. I'm not sure. He works for one of the college, you know, television networks that televises college football. And, he was making some comments about even Coach O with LSU and the journey that he took. So the guy, you know, the USC thing goes south. He coaches at Ole Miss, doesn't have great success, you know, just not the right fit for USC. And they were kind of a train wreck anyway. You know, they didn't have a president, didn't have an athletic director. Then he goes to Ole Miss, not just culturally, just you know, the right fit. You know, but the Louisiana guy with a little bit of that Cajun flavor,
yeah.
You know, I mean, the guy ends up going to LSU, is an interim, ends up with the job, seems like the players like him, and here we are. And then you got his coach Burrow, he's a backup in Ohio State, goes into the transfer portal because he can't get on the field, because he's not as good as the starter up there, and comes to LSU. Simultaneously, they get a coach who just years ago was a graduate assistant who's on the staff of the New Orleans Saints. He comes in, installs this offense, and, you know, so you've got these – Joe Klatt was talking about the journey that these people took, that the route that took them to come to LSU was the right route. You know, in spite of, you could look at the failures like, well, man, he went to Ole Miss and he couldn't coach them. Yeah, being among the right group of people and being in the right place makes a big, big difference. And here you go, look at him. I mean, according to most people that really watch the sport closely, much more closely than I do, and I watch it fairly closely, easily the best quarterback performance in college football history. 60 touchdowns from this guy, you know, just a spectacular year. And he goes from being second string at Ohio State to Heisman Trophy winner and number one, projected number one, not the number one quarterback, the number one pick in the next NFL draft. You know, just, yeah, great, great stories, but he was at LSU, not Ohio State.
Right. And that's what I meant. Not
the Clemson, yeah, yeah.
But LSU guy. And right. But what's incredible, I think, is that, and it would be easy to pick on Ohio State and say, look what you did, you screwed up or whatever. But the reality is that, you know, so many people, you know, we've talked about this just in terms of Gino Auriemma recruiting women for UConn women's basketball. And, you know, there are certain things that the player has to have that are going to make the difference between being successful in their program and not. It doesn't mean they're not going to go to another school somewhere else and have a wildly successful career. They probably will. And they will do it and be more successful than they ever would have been, you know, at UConn, because it just wasn't the right fit. And obviously, when you don't have the right fit, and we talked about, you know, hiring, right? How many times, maybe countless times, where I can certainly remember, and you had agreed that, you know, we get a great resume from someone, the interviews are phenomenal, and then 3 or 4 months later, we're wondering, what is going on here? Why isn't this working out? And understanding, I think, the difference between the people who make it in your organization and the people who don't, identifying what those things are and having the real discipline to say no to a person that otherwise on paper looks really amazing, but you know, that they don't have those one or two things that are going to be so important to thriving in your particular culture. It really isn't any different than, you know, going picking flowers for your yard, and some flowers are full sun and some are, you know, pretty much half or shade or whatever. And they're going to grow great in one spot and they're going to die in the other if you put them in the wrong place. And, you know, I just,
well, and Joe Burrow, to be fair, I mean, the player ahead of him, whose name escapes me, Haskins, 50 touchdowns. I mean, threw 50 touchdowns in a season. Well, Burrow's, for whatever reason, timing, place, system, I don't
call it,
who knows?
Yeah.
Couldn't throw 50 touchdowns. Didn't throw 50. If he could have thrown 50 touchdowns, they would have started him. You know, they're like any other team. They want to win. Yep. They want to perform at a high level. So, you know, there's no question he had a banner year, but it could also be argued that that culture of Coach O, and kind of it was a whole kind of a second chances thing, right? Because you got a coach who went from interim to being the guy, and you got a guy that goes into the transfer portal. He wasn't a starter. So you could see how they were kindred spirits, and the emotional acceptance speech that Burrow's made getting the Heisman.
Yes, was
to LSU and to Coach O kind of was a big indicator to me, okay, I see what's going on here. I kind of get this culture. I kind of get the thing that ties them together. And I know that you've got, well, you've not only got strong opinions, but you've got fairly solid research and way beyond just anecdotal evidence of how that shared connection is critical. It's critical.
Well, yeah, there's no question. I mean, you know, I get back, I was in Seattle, Atlanta, and Atlanta again, and I'm headed out to Edmonton next week, again, doing more of these CEO group workshops. And what's been interesting is we spend more and more time at each of these workshops as we, you know, we work within the framework, of course, of the five factors, the first being having the right people in the room. And it's been really interesting that we spend more and more time talking about that, because you have to cut it up in a lot of different ways in terms of what the right people means, right? So let's say if you've got a group of CEOs. So part of what makes them the right people is they all share that common challenge of having to make decisions for an entire organization. That's what creates, you know, the level of empathy. They are there for a common purpose, you know, to grow and get better, to be better leaders, to grow their companies, to, you know, get really good perspectives and shared experiences from people who, again, share the same challenge that they have. But two other things become real important too. One is a sense of when it comes to the values and how that manifests in the behaviors in terms of participation in the group. Like, what is being a successful contributor to a group like that look like? You know, what do you have to be, you know? And they talk about things like, well, you've got to be open. You've got to be willing to be vulnerable. You've got to be willing to challenge and be challenged by others. You have to, you know, and the list goes on and on. And again, it depends on the group in terms of what the priorities are and how they think about those things. And that becomes, you know, very solid in terms of what binds that group and what that looks like. And, you know, and then finally, it's really very much also about how they're different. Different ages, different genders, different cultural backgrounds, different parts of the country, or even parts of the world where they grew up, and their experiences being so, so different, and their the lens that they look at things through, even though on one hand, there's the shared lens of looking at a situation as a CEO, there's still a big difference in how they see the world. And to be able to share those perspectives and to be able to, you know, I've, you know, a thousand times, right? You've seen CEOs, you know, who rely on other CEOs for advice sometimes directly, you know, sometimes it's just shared experiences and things that help inform their decision. In other cases, they may be looking for, hey, I think I got a choice between A and B here, you know, help me decide which one is correct. And 9 times out of 10, it won't be that they helped him decide between choice A and B. It's that they learned that there was now choice C, D, and E available to them, and that they had no idea, you know, and it wasn't something that they had thought about. And when people come at this from different perspectives, they start asking CEOs the questions that CEOs are no longer asking themselves. They're so steeped and so familiar with their particular industry, and those become kind of the obvious things, but yet someone else who's coming from outside their industry is going to ask those questions. They don't know, but they're going to ask. And then all of a sudden, sometimes those questions lead to the discovery that there's actually another way to do things other than what's the norm in your company or your particular industry that you may find can be really powerful. So this idea of having all the right people in the room, and whether it's all the right people in the room as a peer group or all the right people in the field or on the basketball court as a team. You and I also talked about, and although it was a small consolation, after Clemson lost the national championship in football, it was a night or two later that the basketball team upsets Duke. So, you know, it's pretty incredible when you think about the level that these teams perform and what we ask of these young kids, and yet how much we can learn from them about having the right people in the room. And I think very importantly, not just their accountability they have to the coaches, but the commitment they make to one another when it comes to how do we get better.
The values and the purpose for a group. And I don't mean the purpose of the group itself, but for any group or team to come up with those values. Talk to us a little bit about that process or the hurdles to that.
I think what happens, and the reason that these values get set up in much as I described, is that oftentimes when these groups are set up, there's a recognition that because what happens in the room stays in the room, and that there's a confidentiality around it all, and that people have come here to get help from others that they know they need and they know they can't get outside that room, right? They don't have unfettered access to a group of CEOs who really understand what it's like to sit in that chair. Right, the advice they get from people are, you know, CEO's getting, you know, advice from his marketing person or his HR person or his legal or whatever. Everything comes through that lens and with, you know, a certain outcome that, you know, is definitely biased by how they view the world through whatever specialty they're bringing to the table. You know, your board has governance, you know, over you. Sometimes there are certain things that you don't always want to talk to your board about the fact that, hey, I'm not really sure what we're doing here or why, sure. you know, but yet you can go into another room behind closed doors with the CEO and say, I'm not sure. You know, it's not what you want to put out to your employees or to your board or something like that. But there are times where, you know, many times where CEOs are as challenged as anyone when it comes to trying to just figure things out and know what's the right course of action here. And the ability to walk in a room with other people and to be vulnerable enough to say, I'm not sure about this. I need to tear this apart with other people who can give me some real perspective on this to help me come to my own conclusion. And I think this is where the difference between part of a group like this is different from hiring a consulting firm. And beating up on consulting firms by any stretch. I mean, this is an incredible resource. But oftentimes what happens when a consulting firm comes in and ends up producing a report with recommendations about what you should do, you don't really own those recommendations in the same way you might if you really worked the problem with a number of other of your peers and are able to kind of come to a place where you can own the solution. And once you have, play a part in creating it and you feel you can own it, there's a far more greater likelihood that you're going to implement it and implement it successfully. I think that when we start talking about the values piece, once you recognize that this setting is unlike anything that you have ever experienced anywhere else, you start treating it that way on every level. And it's what I think invites people's ability to be open and be vulnerable and be able to be real with one another. They don't have to put their best face forward. They're a real important person in that room, but they're not the most important person in that room by any stretch. And it's really great to watch. It's great to see. It's great to see different groups who have an emphasis on different things. The value and importance of, we kind of break commitment, for example, down into three buckets, where commitment is really comprised of attendance, of always being there, being committed to being at that meeting, that it's a hard meeting on your schedule, that when you do show up, you will have prepared for that meeting. You don't show up there without really putting your head behind what happened at the last meeting and what are the things I need to think about and what do I want to bring to the group and what, and have I reviewed everything that any of the group members have prepared for me so that I'm ready to give my best in the context of a conversation. So, yeah.
The values, I'm just curious. So at an individual level, I assume you've got values at an individual level. I've got certain values. You've got certain values. They may or may not be quite the same. They could be very different. They could even be quite opposite. And then we've got kind of group values. What are your insights about those distinctions and how those can impact positively or negatively, the whole group dynamic?
Well, part of what we talk a lot about is that a great group begins with me, right? So I have to be the one and take ownership and accept personal responsibility for how I show up to the group in every way. How well do I prepare? How well do I listen? The third component of that commitment piece we talked about was really being present and being fully engaged, right? I think the more that we exhibit those behaviors, model them for ourselves, that they are also picked up and practiced, by the group so that it becomes a way that the group does things, right? We know the famous definition of culture is it's how we do things around here. So every group has its own culture. Every group has its ways that they do things, inside and outside their meetings that develop over time based not only on values, but on the behaviors. This is where I think sometimes it isn't so much having different values, but different interpretations of the same value. And so the greater clarity a group can have around not just what the values are, but what the behaviors need to be, how does it show up? Then I think that tends to strengthen both the individual and the group dynamic that is that's going on there.
Well, and that's something that's easier to get on the same page. We can all come to an agreement that, okay, we need to be here. We need to be on time. All of those things.
But coming to agreement on it and doing it is a whole other.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Well, it's that knowing doing gap, right? We know to do it, but we just don't do it.
Yeah.
Talk to us. I'm curious the differences in all of your experiences with CEO groups, and particularly the length of time that these groups have been together. I'm curious when it comes to right people and all of the context of this conversation today, which is really on people.
Right.
And the difference in, say, of a group that's been together for an extended period of time versus a group that maybe hasn't had as much time together. What differences have you noticed in all of your work with regard to this people part of it?
What I think people find fascinating is that when you look at the five factors and you look at the framework that I bring into a workshop, you can easily see where for a brand new group, perfect, right? Because you come in there, you look one another in the eye, you come to agreement on how we want to behave, where we want to be, how we're going to get there. And you've now just bought into all of that. And you've also set now, as I mentioned, the criteria for any new member that wants to come in, that you want to chin the bar, you know, and be part of this group. Here's what the expectations are. And everyone's got clarity around all of that. And, you know, that, you know, obviously becomes hugely, hugely important.
Well, and that's an ideal. So you now go into a group and, okay, some are lackluster, some are more committed than others. Because you've told enough stories of people that didn't quite attend the way they should have and had no awareness that they were having the impact on the group. So you take a seasoned group and you bring this kind of insight, those reactions.
Yeah. Yeah. So when you go to a seasoned group, you start thinking that, all right, I'm going to go through all these five factors on this thing. And they're all going to be like, yeah, we got that. You know what I mean? Like, you know, except when you, and it's like no different in any kind of relationship you have with anyone. I don't care if it's your spouse, your friend or things like that. You know, the moment you feel like, oh, we got this, and then you don't pay attention to it anymore is when you don't got this anymore. Right. Mm-hmm. So, people can have what they believe to be a really safe and confidential environment. So for brand new groups, sometimes they don't always leverage that environment as effectively as they could, mostly because they lack a certain familiarity and trust and being open. And it just, they just take some time to get there. With a more experienced group, if you've had a lot of people to get together, the relationships become so close that now all of a sudden, you get people who don't want to challenge anyone or hurt anyone's feelings or get it. So now all of a sudden you have all this topic avoidance and all of these elephants in the room that never get addressed and stuff like that because everyone wants to play nice. You know, both are need work, you know, both need, you know, you guys aren't coming together here every day just to be each other's buddies. You know, I mean, I'm pretty sure you can kind of handle that without having to pay dues and without, you know, spending a whole day here. You know, if you're actually here to be one another's counsel and to have this place that you've, you know, recognized as something really different from any other group situation that you're part of in any other part of your life, then keeping it that way is a challenge. You know, maintaining that, keeping that fresh, keeping things top of mind, keeping that safe and confidential environment top of mind, making sure that when you are talking about whatever topic comes up, whether it's a challenge, whether it's an opportunity, whatever, that these things are done with the same level of discipline. There's no shortcuts. There's no, you know, there's a certain way and a certain discipline and understanding about how people help one another ask really, really great questions. And hopefully you're getting better and better at that all the time and not like, okay, isn't that a problem we heard about 3 years ago and this is what we did, up, 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 and it's done. And, you know, all of a sudden you're on to the next thing. And that's not helping anybody. And we had a great conversation yesterday with a group where, you know, we talked about having the right answer to the wrong question can really screw you up, you know, in a big way every time. And, you know, so just making sure that these people are coming to the table, really asking the right questions of themselves is not something that you just are together for X number of years and you just know how to do it and all that without really making sure It's a little like golf in that way. You know, you know how to hit the golf ball, but you don't always hit it down the middle every single time unless you're really paying attention. And even then, it's difficult. So yeah. I think there's a certain, you know, fair comparison there when it comes to how to function in a group where there's constant change. It's a living, breathing organism. You've got people coming, people going. You've got some businesses growing really quickly, others not so much. People having challenges personally, professionally. I mean, it is an absolute challenge to not only lead a group like that, but to be a member of it and constantly be paying attention to how this group is and how it's changing and morphing and where you all can contribute most effectively. So
revisiting that kind of that individual as we wind down here, I know we're running out of time, but that individual responsibility, do you find, and what insights would you want to share? Because I've seen this, you've seen it way more than I've seen it, that there are these breakthrough moments so that if I do my work and I show up the way I'm supposed to show up and I exhibit all of these behaviors that I know are ideal, not only for me, but for the group, that boy, there's this cascading effect that all of a sudden, if people see me bring something to the table that maybe they might have been reticent to bring up, or if they see me display some courage or some vulnerability or whatever it may be, that maybe there's been some reluctance, that boy, the dominoes just, you just begin to see it kind of take over the room. And all of a sudden, you know, so that my point is that that individual responsibility and that individual leadership can have big, big power on the whole group dynamic.
Yeah. I mean, in that moment and for the future, right? So if someone, and again, I always think about when anyone's sharing anything difficult, it's a real act of courage, but an act of generosity as well. I mean, it's difficult to put yourself out there. And yet when you see the value it has for so many other people in the room, when you're sharing something, that chances are good that there are other people that may in fact be experiencing something very similar. At the same time, people have been through it before, people who may go through it somewhere in the future, who have had the benefit of having a deep conversation about a topic that oftentimes can go very easily undiscussed. It's hugely, it's hugely powerful to watch. And I think for groups that have experienced that, they get it. They appreciate it. The question is, how do you make sure that, again, with the constant changes and constant things that are happening in the world around us and the group itself, and you know that, how do you keep that alive? And it's a real challenge, which is why the workshop, which I've done it for everything from a group's first meeting to a group that was together for over 18 years with many of the founding members still in it, and I don't care what group it is, everybody needs some attention. They need to pay attention to something that they're missing. And usually they need to pay attention to most of the five factors in one way, shape, or form. There's something in there that they know they're not exactly clicking on all cylinders, and they just have to figure out. And they find also that they easily do it. I think it's easy for people who are unfamiliar with going into a peer group and think that it's some kind of spectator sport, you know, that you just sit back in your seat and say, all right, bring me value, you know, right. And you just sit there and you just get it like you're sitting in a classroom taking notes. That isn't how this goes. I mean, you are the learner and the teacher at the same time. And, you know, you get to get in there and play and share who you are and what you know, and what those experiences have been. And then, you know, so I make that investment of myself for the ballpark of 12, 16, 18 other people in the room, and I will get that back that many fold from everyone else there. And so I think once people start to really see that, and it doesn't take long, people can be in groups, I think, for a fairly short period of time and realize, wow, this is A, it's different, and B, they totally get the value of it, even though when it's explained to them, oftentimes it's not like, okay, press this button and then this magical thing will happen. It's oftentimes, you know, engage with others in a way where you share experiences and ask questions of one another that get you thinking about your business in a way that you never might have done so without, you know, that kind of dialogue, and then watch what happens when that occurs. And it's pretty cool.
Okay. We'll end with an accountability section here, since you told us that you were working on the new book, which is going to be about this very topic, these five factors. So we'll help hold you accountable and cheer you on. So let our audience know again kind of what time frame you're hoping to execute this. And
yeah, I'm looking at completing this I think a really tight draft of the manuscript before the end of February. And the book basically is about inside the five factors. It goes from the original articulation of what the five factors are to a different model, and then an ever evolving kind of look at this that will be part of what's going to be called Inside the Five Factors, where we'll look at each of them as informed by real experiences and real groups with real members that talk about some of the most common and some of the more uncommon challenges too, but certainly some of the more common challenges that face look at for each of these areas. And then I think some real tools for how to address them. And again, what's important, I think, about it is what we've learned about high-performing groups and what they can tell us about how to make our teams perform more effectively in the workplace, I think, is most certainly the theme. So,
and we're looking at a summer-ish publication?
No, May.
May?
Yeah.
Man, look at you. You're stepping it up. I like it. I like it. Bold, audacious.
You got to go big or go home.
Yeah, that's right.
But it's 20. Yeah, but getting it out there, there's a, like I said, there's a publisher show that has a lot of business authors there at the end of May in New York that I want to be part of with the book. And, there's a number of other things around this that I really want to launch in terms of how to put the content in people's hands, some of which, you know, can happen because I come to your company or I come to your group and we do that together. But I mostly want to figure out how we scale this in a way that makes the content available to people, both in a way that's convenient and reasonably priced for them, that can really make a difference in their organization. Because ultimately, the more that we can get a lot of these principles out there globally, the more effective teams are at working better together, particularly, I think, over the next 5, 10, 15 years, where I think there's going to be a tremendous number of changes in the workplace and how we work, then the way we work together is never going to be more important. And so I think the timing for, all of this, I think, is going to be really essential for everyone. And, no need to keep it a secret. Let's get it out there.
Yeah. Keep up. By subscribing to the podcast, we appreciate you, the listeners and the viewers. We appreciate you watching on YouTube and going to the website. You can keep up with all of the work that Leo is engaged in and undertaking at leobattari.com. It's leobottari.com. And I'll give you the last word.
And, I'm going to ask you to tell people how they can sign up and fill those final few spots in your group that you're going to be getting rolling very, very soon.
Yeah, I'm forming a charter group. You and I have talked, and I'm not sure if there will be a next group, and if there is, I'm not sure what that group will consist of, but you and I have talked about this shared connection, and this first one is going to be what I've affectionately called a group of kind of my people. Small to medium-sized business owners. I'm looking for number ones. So if you are a small to medium-sized business owner anywhere in the United States, no offense to our foreign listeners, but I just don't want to deal with a whole bunch of time zones. So this is a virtual online group. You can find the details by going to thepeeradvantage.com. Thanks for that opportunity.
There we go. All right. Have a great day.
Thanks, everybody. To learn more about our show and what we do, to submit questions to us, and to subscribe to What Anyone Can Do podcast, please visit our website, whatanyonecando.com. What Anyone Can Do podcast is hosted by Leo Battari and me, Randy Cantrell. Music provided by Kevin MacLeod is Vibe Ace, licensed under Creative Commons by Attribution 3.0 license. Thanks for watching or listening. We hope you'll share the podcast.